What's made COVID-19 so devastating is how easily it can be spread. Some of the people who have it now knew they were at increased risk.
But through the night, his breathing went, as if he couldn't breathe deep enough. So we rung 111 and they sent an ambulance straight away for him.
Karen Smith, a hospital cleaner, has COVID-19. She's brought it home to her husband, Mal. He's also a hospital worker, a porter. Mal already has a chronic lung disease. Although Mal was sent home from work to be shielded in the UK lockdown, Karen was expected to keep going in. Just as she feared, Mal is much sicker than she is.
I just felt rubbish. Shortness of breath and temperature up and down and just feel horrible.
So Karen got swabbed 10 days ago, didn't
yeah.
she? And she's been okay. How soon after she got her symptoms did you get your symptoms?
A couple of days. Started and then I went to have my swabs in that and positive. I'm 8-0 since Saturday.
And how's your breathing?
I've struggled.
And then the ambulance has come and picked you up and
yeah.
you. And she can't come in with you?
No.
I've just seen him in A&E, Karen, and he looks fine. He'll be fine, I think, Karen. They're just waiting for his bloods to come back. But I think he'll be all right.
So I'm so worried, Charlie, especially with his breathing and his colour won't right.
The doctor Karen is speaking to is John Wright, an epidemiologist at Bradford Royal Infirmary. He's been keeping an audio diary and interviewing colleagues and patients for BBC Radio 4 since the week before the lockdown began. This is the 8th programme in our series. What you'll hear has been recorded by Dr. Wright. In the past, he's worked in outbreaks of Ebola, cholera and HIV in Africa.
So it's important that we pick it up if he is deteriorating. So you've done the right thing and let's just make sure he's OK.
COVID-19's success in global domination lies in its high transmission rate. There have been other more deadly coronavirus epidemics. In 2003, the SARS virus caused almost 10,000 cases, of whom 1 in 10 died. 10 years later, the MERS virus led to 2,000 cases, and almost 1 in 3 of these patients died. COVID-19 is less fatal, but it's much more infective. Over 4 million cases worldwide so far. All of these viral epidemics have one thing in common. They target healthcare workers early and often.
Patterns of infection are emerging now that demonstrate the dangers of large social gatherings in this time of COVID-19. On the 10th of March, the day after Italy locked down, a big horse racing festival at Cheltenham in Gloucester went ahead. There are now calls for an inquiry into whether that contributed to a spike in COVID deaths in that area. In Bradford, over the same period, the Hussein family held a big funeral in the city's central mosque to mark the passing of Noor Hussein, who came to Bradford from Pakistan in the 1960s to work in the mills. He was in his 90s.
Well, my father passed away and we'd gone with his body to Pakistan. It had been his dearest wish. An absolute sincerest wish to be buried in Pakistan. So he's an old soldier, fought in the Second World War, very determined old man. And he kind of had...
Where was he fighting in the Second World War?
He fought in Burma.
Against Japanese?
Yeah. And I always said to him, I will respect your wish. So he passed away. He took his body to Pakistan. It was his wish to be buried next to his brother.
Three generations of the Hussein family live together. Noor's son, Mohammed, who's 51 and a criminal lawyer with his own firm, flew to Pakistan with his father's body on March the 11th. His sons oversaw the funeral in Bradford. Almost as soon as it was over, they became ill with symptoms of COVID-19. Haroon Hussein is a doctor at a hospital in Hull.
I think that funeral was probably a source of infection. You know, the country went into lockdown shortly after. So, you know, the reports are coming out now that coronavirus was in the population for a significant period of time, probably before we realised. So, you know, if you've got a gathering of that many people, it increases your chances that maybe one of them had it. The last day of the funeral was the Thursday. My brother became symptomatic. So I went to work, actually, on the Monday, and my brother became symptomatic Monday evening. I became symptomatic, I think, a day or 2 days after him. And then my father returned from Pakistan on the Wednesday. And we tried to, you know, distance ourselves, but when you're living in one household, it's nigh on impossible. You know, there's only a certain number of bathrooms. There's only one fridge. There's only, you know, one kitchen, you know.
When their dad got back from Pakistan, he quickly fell ill. And so they soon discovered, did many other people who'd gathered to pay tribute to Noor Hussein.
The first news we had was my dad's cousin's eldest son. He was the first person to become unwell, and I think he was one of the first patients to be admitted to ICU. So his father had been quite unwell with it, and his grandmother, she also got admitted. And then his first cousin, who's also my first cousin, he also got admitted. So within one household, you've got four individuals. So there was a relative who's in Oldham, so he'd come to the funeral. He had become unwell with it, and unfortunately he'd passed away. So my father spoke to his son to pass his condolences to him when he passed away, and this was in the week my dad was unwell before he got admitted to hospital. And he was telling us he's unwell with it, and his father's passed away with it, and his brother was in the ICU with COVID as well. And then there was another elderly chap, and he unfortunately had passed away with it as well. And again, he'd attended the funeral.
Mohammed Hussein, Noor's son, was much sicker than his boys and had to be admitted to hospital.
I remember being taken into hospital by the ambulance. As I came in, I saw an uncle of mine. So in the waiting area, as you're brought in by the ambulance, there's my uncle and there's me. We're both wearing masks, and I'm saying to him, are you OK? I understand he's now died.
Was he admitted at the same time?
Yeah.
To one of the wards?
Seeing how this infection spreads, doctors wonder how the NHS will get back to the business as usual promised in the government press briefings.
Tuesday, the 5th of May. The head of the NHS has written to all hospitals in the UK, setting out his ambition to return to normal by 6 weeks' time. It's a goal we all support, but it feels a little disconnected from what's happening at the COVID coalface. Patients continue to knock at our hospital door in steady and relentless numbers, and the new guidance about screening all admissions mean that we are picking up new and unexpected cases, blurring our neat green zone, red zone boundaries. It's all become very messy.
What's being planned is for the routine work of hospitals suspended for the lockdown to start up again. The elective surgery for debilitating but not life-threatening conditions, things like cataracts, arthritic knees and hips. Emergency and essential services have been continuing in hospitals, but as Dr. Wright said in his diary entry, it's impossible to keep it COVID-free.
Hi, Lucien.
Hiya.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good to
how
see
are you?
Again. Not bad, thank you. So we've been invited by Professor Wright to...
Nasheen Khalig, a young mother aged 37, has needed dialysis for kidney failure on and off for 10 years. When she came to Bradford Royal Infirmary at the start of the lockdown for one of her regular sessions of dialysis, she has three a week, 4 hours long each, she was diagnosed with COVID-19.
You just had a bit of a cough at the time?
Yeah,
no fever.
And this cough I'd had for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I remember we were laughing and joking about it when I went in. The doctors are like, no, let's have a quick check of you. And I'm like, I've had it for 6 weeks, I'm fine. And I was fine, they checked all my temperature, my sats, everything was fine. And it was literally 45 minutes before my session was ending that I spiked a temperature of something like 39.9. And that's when they're like, OK, something's wrong, we'll go get a doctor. That was the nurses. And then from there, it just escalated overnight. From when I actually got diagnosed, that's when I felt really poorly.
And tell us what happened.
It was just literally temperature, body aches, shivers. I was physically sick, headache, everything. It's just a blur. The next few days went through. It's just, you just didn't even realise, is it day, is it night? I was just in absolute agony, coughing through the night so much I literally couldn't breathe.
The staff were worried that other patients had been infected in the hospital, but it doesn't seem to have happened so far. Dr. John Stoves is a kidney specialist.
At the front door, of course, we check temperatures as well on the dialysis unit to make sure nobody's... That everybody's free of symptoms before coming in and also free of a temperature before coming in.
And how many of our dialysis patients have picked up COVID-19 then?
We have a total just over 20, John, at the moment, so that of a population of 300, it's that kind of a percentage, 7%, that sort of figure.
And do you think patients are picking it up from the community and bringing it in, or are they picking it up from the hospital, or is it a mixture of the two?
That's a good question. I think we've tested the water with that. We had two or three cases in close proximity and in the same room, so we wondered about ongoing spread within the unit, and we got permission to swab to rooms worth of patients, and they were all negative, so there was an indication there that perhaps that it was from the community rather than spread within the unit. But we're not complacent about that, and we were first in the region to get masks for our staff.
When Dr. Wright began his recordings, COVID-19 was thought to be a lung disease where the life-saving treatment would be intubated ventilation with patients anaesthetised in intensive care. As the weeks have passed, clinicians have used less invasive ventilators and used them earlier, CPAP machines, that blow oxygen into the lungs, keeping them inflated. Predictions in March were that 30% of patients would be on ventilators in intensive care units. As it's turned out, it's less than 20% nationally and less than 10% in Bradford. Dr. Tom Lawton is a consultant in critical care.
I genuinely believe we've managed to pitch it right here by being out on the wards and supporting people to deliver care that they're not used to delivering in that kind of environment. But by using very sort of simple machines that are designed to make it all as easy as possible, and having brilliant staff who are prepared to jump and do everything so quickly. But we haven't brought as many people to intensive care as we thought we would, and yet our patients don't seem to have suffered as a result.
It's early days, but the first peak of COVID-19 in Bradford is passing, although, as John Wright said, there's still a steady stream of patients being admitted, currently around 20 a day. It looks as though this hospital has done relatively well in nursing the very sick to recovery. Preliminary data shows the death rate at Bradford Royal Infirmary is 23%. That's lower than national figures.
Wednesday, the 6th of May. The UK's death toll overtakes Italy to top a European championship that no one wants to win. Back in March, the goal of keeping deaths below 20,000 seemed shocking enough. Today, as we soar past 30,000 precious lives lost, it is hard to know where this grim count will end. As with the rest of the country, there has been a sharp rise in deaths in Bradford. In hospital from COVID, but also non-COVID deaths in the community and in care homes. Funeral directors are some of the busiest people still in work. At the hospital, we have had to make our own arrangements to deal with an unprecedented rise in the number of patients dying due to COVID-19.
Martin Walker manages the hospital mortuary.
It's the biggest potential rise in the death toll in about 100 years. And we've got to look at PPE, we've got to look at staffing levels. We're normally a team of two, but now we've got extra staff in, so we're now a team of five.
To cope with the surge?
To cope with the surge, yeah, that's right. And we're working now on a seven-day rota, whereas before we'd just be Monday to Friday.
Patients die in hospital, we're used to dealing with that, not at the same rate as happening at the moment. These are people who've died with COVID-19 who will still be infectious.
Yeah.
Are you're all wearing PPE?
As we know, although the risk is somewhat minimal, but there is always a risk. If we have one, then suddenly it goes up to five, then up to 20, then that risk factor is increased for each case we get. So minimum handling. We have one who's a clean person, one who's what we call a circulator, so they will do the paperwork. We book all deceased in the same, so we have to check ID, property. And we check obviously the condition of the deceased as well, so we need to clean them should we need to. So all that has to be taken into account. So we have to ensure that the staff are able to carry out that procedure, that they are protected by appropriate PPE. And then emotionally, they can deal with it as well.
Yeah, you don't think about that, actually. I suppose you're used to dealing with death.
Yeah.
This is your job. But to deal with it at this level of the numbers, does that create a big emotional burden?
It can. if you let it, I think, providing you have time out, you know, we have these wobble rooms. Like I have a room where I've said that I can go and have a quiet time if they need to. So that is a concern for me. I need to make sure that their well-being is priority and that they are able to deal with that.
The pandemic has meant that young doctors in training have found themselves working on the COVID wards. Anish Vistry volunteered to help provide palliative care to patients dying from COVID-19. He had some experience through work he'd done at a local hospice. Some patients deteriorate and die despite all the treatments the doctors try.
I've actually seen quite a lot of death compared to the other juniors here, and it has been of COVID. And it's the way I see it is sometimes it's just a death that's happened that shouldn't have happened, and it's a terrible situation, and I just take it as it comes, and I've done the small things that matter. So when a patient arrives, they arrive really distressed. Sometimes they've been taken off the ventilators, and if you've had a ventilator, like a CPAP machine, opening your lungs up for the last 2 weeks and you're suddenly not there, they arrive really distressed. And all I've done is use that knowledge I've gained through Marie Curie and done the right medications to make them feel comfortable, because that's the focus at that point. And on top of that, I've used all the basic things like mouth care, so important, and just making sure the positioning's right, and actually just holding the hand, making sure there's a staff member to hold the hand, because it's, I can imagine it's incredibly scary for people as they're gasping for air, they've got no relatives around, it's a real horrible situation. And one of the nights I remember, patient arrived and he was a bit more alert, and when it's more alert it's quite distressing for the staff members as well. And one of the things I did was I was just like making sure he was comfortable, and he just goes, my back's itching. Just the natural thing was to lean forward and scratch my back. And nurses were in tears just at how small something is, but so meaningful. And with all this death and everything, it's the most difficult thing is making the phone calls to the relatives. I found that incredibly tough. I've not, before all of this, before Marie Curie, before everything, I've not, never seen death before. I've not even had a touch wood. I've never even had a family member die that's been close to me. So to see it unfold like this.
The general absence of families and other visitors on these COVID wards as part of infection control may explain a flood of damaging fake news reports that have been posted and sent as messages. Some claim that the higher death rate among Black, Asian and other ethnic minority patients is because they are being killed off by the very hospital staff meant to help them. Fozia Hyatt, a consultant anaesthetist, has been sent some disturbing texts, emails and videos.
This is the month of Ramadan and we fast in our family, we are practicing, and it was quite hard to have somebody send me a message to say, you're a sellout, you're corrupt, you're a mushroom, you're putting
people.
Yeah, apparently, I googled this, and apparently it means when you're in the dark about things and when management feeds you rubbish.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're getting people to sign DNR forms for no resuscitation, advocating sedation. I'll sort of abbreviate all this. Is it true that WHO and IMF have been giving bribes to the NHS for 4,000 for testing and COVID-19, £13,000 for COVID deaths and certificates, putting money, £39,000 to put people on a ventilator? How much are they paying you? And then he's basically carried on to say, there's no virus, I can accompany you to see an infected patient without any PPE and I'll not catch anything. And then finally, this is a bit that was quite, you know, I found quite distressing, was, please stop selling out and stand up for the truth. You'll be held responsible in the court of Allah for the deaths of these people for negligence in this life, and life is very short. I don't know why I find that really upsetting, but I do. I find it really distressing.
Dr. Hyatt has reported the messages to the police, and she's asking the president of the Bradford Council of Mosques, Zulfi Karim, for advice on how she should respond. He's also promised to investigate and asked Dr. Hyatt to talk about it on Ramadan Radio, a community station.
I can't apologise on their behalf, but it's just awful that you guys are going through this. And what I will do, John, I will get Ishtiak and my guys at Council for Mosque in the office just to do a bit of digging around.
And what we are seeing now, because I've seen it myself, is people are presenting late, and late to detriment to themselves. And I just think that we need to do something a bit more.
And this is such an important message. I don't know if you're picking up elsewhere, but some of the national discussions about COVID and the BAME community is that these anxieties, these false rumours about what's going on in the hospital are happening in London and Birmingham as well. So it's widespread.
And I know how difficult these things are, especially with these sort of messages, when you're on your front line and all you're trying to do is save lives.
And these few voices, these accusations, I think is really demoralising. And I felt really, really quite sad for everyone that is working so hard. You know, it felt very personal to me and my family because there was, you know, comments about would I have DNRs and on my parents. Well, the answer is yes, if it was appropriate, yes, I would. You know, it's all about looking at all the different parameters, you know. Medicine's, you know, they always say, isn't it, it's an art, not just a science. It's both of them. So I think that's really important to remember.
Being intubated and ventilated on ICU turns out to be a long and rocky road. In one of our Red Zone ICUs, Mohammed is one of our success stories. A silver beard highlights his distinguished features. The glint in his eye is the only clue to his incredible fight for life.
I'm Dr. Wright.
I think we met before, but it was when you were on the breathing machine. Yeah.
Dr. Debbie Horner is a consultant in intensive care.
I think I'm getting a lot of that.
Been very poorly, but I think I've turned the corner, and I am so grateful for the hard work.
In Bradford, of 35 people who've been placed on intubated ventilators, only three have come off so far. Mohammed Hussain is one of them, the criminal lawyer whose father's funeral seems to have unintentionally helped spread COVID-19. Mohammed was unconscious for 5 weeks.
It was bizarre, because, you know, there's this chunk of your life and you've been looking across and, oh, it's beginning of May. You think, what do you mean beginning of May? You know, it was March. Just coming to the end of March. Where's the rest of it gone?
What's his prognosis like? What's going to happen to him over the next few weeks and months?
So one of the things that we've noticed with the patients who've had tracheostomy, not all of them, but quite a lot of them are younger than patients that we've often had with tracheostomies before, and they seem to be getting a sort of degree of their physical strength back quicker than we have seen in other patients. Now, that's not to say that they don't need rehab, because they do, and that's another thing that we're looking at in the hospital in terms of how we can provide that rehabilitation to get people back to their or as close as we can to their pre-COVID function. But even over the course of a few days, you can see how people's ability to get up, to start caring for themselves, is exponentially improved, which is really reassuring, actually. The one group that I would say struggle more are those who have perhaps started to develop some pulmonary fibrosis, and we have had patients that have been quite slow to come off oxygen. In certain cases, we've given high-dose steroids to try and improve that lung function, and we've seen that nationally, that there are a subset of patients who are developing this pulmonary fibrosis who are struggling then to get off the oxygen as quickly as others.
I had no other recollection, and then I recall coming round and everybody reacting to it. The nurses saying, oh, it's good to see you, good to speak to you. We've been looking after you. The doctors come in saying hi. Again, there was some paranoia to begin with. I thought these people trying to trick me, you know.
Because you don't remember being intubated or going to ICU at all, do you?
I don't remember being intubated at all.
So you just woke up and suddenly you're in this strange environment.
Yeah, and then I'm being told things. And I'm telling myself, that's not right. If that's not right, then they're obviously trying to pull a fast one. What's going on? What's all this about? And then more and more kind of started to make sense. Just absolutely amazing, amazing people. You know, not just in relation to the care, to the patients, but also to the commitment to their colleagues, So a lot of the people who have been working on the ICU on this corona virus thing, many of them are not ICU nurses.
While Mohammed Hussein was on the ventilator, he was regularly turned by another volunteer team of clinicians.
Hi, my name's Harry Barjett. I'm a radiologist at Bradford Teaching Hospitals. My normal day job is I look after the imaging of patients with kidney, prostate and bladder cancer. And one of the general surgeons has been looking for volunteers to do anything, you know, portering, nursing or whatever. And there was one job which came up, which was proning. So patients with COVID seem to do better if they're ventilated on their tummy rather than on their back. And they generally spend about 16 hours on their tummy, 8 hours on their back. And so they need to be turned twice a day. And therefore, we offered ourselves as a proning team, or we're called the RATTERS, the radiology turning team. And
maybe not such a good term in the days of plague. Rats and plagues are not a great combination.
We couldn't think of a more kind of... you could say that we are the primary radiology turning team, but yeah, that comes out with a different an acronym. And so our job is to create a robust rotor so that the intensive care can just rely that radiology will produce a team at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock every day. And we go up, put on our PPE, go on, and we're taken by the intensivists to whichever patients need to be turned.
The choreography is fascinating, isn't it?
It
how
is.
You do this.
Yes.
Have you been able to learn it fairly quickly then?
Yes. There is always the rule in medicine, see one, do one, teach one. So we've seen one, we've done one, and now we're teaching. So we've kind of tried to mix up our teams, that we've got experienced people and new people, put the lads up towards the head end and the ladies more down towards the feet end. There is a disproportionate...
Heavier aspects of the body, yeah. And you're very highly technically gifted specialist in radiology, Harry.
Yes.
And now you're...
Yes.
...turning patients.
Yes. And that's...
Doing your bit.
Yes.
And then you start realising how much the people in the ICU have done, you know, day and night. Words can't demonstrate what I feel.
Mohammed Hussein has now moved out of intensive care and is beginning the long, slow process of rehabilitation on a stroke ward. He keeps in daily contact with his family by video phone.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. That was a nice meal.
Nice one. I'm glad you enjoyed that meal.
My brother-in-law brought me some food and I was famished. So I think it won't be long before I'll be out because my appetite's up and I'm eating well. But I've just discovered some quite alarming statistics about Asians from the subcontinent, quite a high percent of people on ventilators not making it. And I was aware that only two people had made it from the ventilators at BRI. So I feel a bit blessed, to be honest. And I think the power of prayer has got a lot to do with that. I had nuns in North Yorkshire praying for me. I had the full spectrum of faiths all over the world praying for me. I had people from India, in Gujarat, in Pakistan, in America, Scotland. So I'm sure that somewhere somebody said something that moved somebody who had a saying in whether I was staying on this earth or not.
Yeah, no, I think we're so fortunate, so blessed.
I'm on a number of group apps and I'm reading through the messages, and a common theme through all of them says, oh, he's too stubborn, he's too tough, he'll be all right. So I didn't know that was how I was viewed by a lot of people.
Oh, you did know that. You did know that. That's a lie.
But, yeah, I'm a stubborn old bugger.